Hi, my name is Yvonne Schulte, and I am an alcoholic. And it's such a pleasure to see you all here this evening for you guys, for Rick and I, it's this afternoon. I have so many old friends on here right now, and it's just lovely to see you. Thanks so much, Billy, for inviting me out here. I can't wait to come out there and visit in person. We'll be able to do that again soon enough, right? And I'm Curtis, I love seeing you in a coat and tie. That is so exciting for me to see the leader of a meeting in a coat and tie. That is how we do it in my home group, and I absolutely love that. It touches my heart. We actually lost another one today in my home group, Pacific group, and not someone that spoke a lot. His name is Joe Sandusky, but he was sponsored by Clancy forever and sponsored a lot of men in Pacific group, and was a good man. And what a year it's been. Yeah. And I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I no longer crawl into bed and am unable to get out, right? Like, I used to wear life so heavy, and it's not like that. It's been quite a year, and I, to be honest with you, in some respects, it feels a little unreal, like I'm not sure I've actually accepted that Clancy's gone, because I don't leave the house very much. It'll be another thing to show up at my home group and have him not be there, or show up at, I hope we have the yard again someday. I'm a regular. I run the women's side of the yard, as a matter of fact. And I love it there when I'm not out of town on the weekends. But it's been definitely a year that I am grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet the silver lining here, right, is being able to connect with so many people I have known and loved. Like, Al and Allison have known me since I was a newcomer. I've been sober since February 10th, 1994. And I came to my home group, Pacific group, when I was 7 years sober. And there were, a few people who had met me along the way there. But they didn't know me that well. I don't see a lot of people who have known me since I was new. I love that. And Pete and I, of course, have known each other since third grade. So that's always lovely. I absolutely love that. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have these different connections. Anyways, I'm so grateful to see all your faces, and thank you so much. Rick, for showing up. I'm going to tell you to the best of my ability in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, what I'm like today. I all I can do is the best I can with the description of myself. My ego gets in the way of seeing myself very clearly, but I try my best to see it. And I often say, ask my daughter, right? I went for a hike this morning. It's just been a lovely, I live in Los Angeles, so, we have great weather most of the time. I went for a hike this morning, saw the ocean, and my daughter was sick yesterday, stomach flu kind of a thing. And I went, and she wanted her mom to cuddle her, which is just the sweetest, cutest thing. So I went and cuddled her and let her husband go to the grocery store while I did that, and fed her chicken soup. And then I came here, and I just, I'm my best gauge of how I'm doing is the relationship I have with my daughter. And I like to say, and many of you know this already, my daughter's sober 12 years now, 12 and a half, as a matter of fact. And I think our relationship says much more about her program, honestly, than it does about mine. But, I was born in Los Angeles. I lived here in LA till I was 8 years old. I'm adopted. I don't really care about that, but I'm the only alcoholic in my family. My parents, oh, bless their little hearts. My parents were such good parents. They've both passed on. But I was raised in a devout Catholic family. I was raised with God. My mother was the best example of a relationship with God I've ever seen anywhere in my life. My mother, I hope someday And I love God very much, but I hope someday to have a fraction of what my mother had. And I remember, like, as a teenager, having the fury and contempt of a teenager who, you know, has separated from God. And I used to think that my mother was slow because of her faith in God. And I used to try to convince her that God didn't exist. And she would just look at me. She was unshakable, right? I love Bill says, no later vicissitude could have shaken my mother. No vicissitude could have shaken my mother she would look at me and she would just say simply, Yvonne, that's what faith is. And I just thought that was the dumbest response. And today I understand it. That's what faith is. So I was raised in this sweet, sweet Catholic family. My mother met my father in the Newman Club in college and they got married. They fell in love. They got married. I have an older brother and a sister. My mother had a really hard time getting pregnant, so they adopted me and my sister. And I was just raised in this very, very sweet family. And I'm so grateful that my parents got my brother because my brother is like, he's the child you want, right? I mean, look, my mother adored me, but my brother is the child you want. And I always laugh about this, but, you know, graduated high school, started college, you know, 3 months later, like you're supposed to. Graduated college 4 years later, met his wife in college. They're still married. They have 3 children. You know, they're looking forward to retirement now. They're just really good people. They never had trouble paying bills. You know, they paid their debts first, like that kind of stuff. Just like that is how they live on the natch. And then there's my sister whose priest tells her she belongs in the program of Al-Anon. and I agree with him, but I don't tell her that. She loves alcoholics. I was her favorite until she started breeding them. And then, you know, she's just, you know, it's just, there's alcoholism all around my sister. She's like a moth to the light of alcoholism, really. And my sister got, she's 8 years older than I am. When she was 12 years old, she was 5'10½", which is how tall she is. She's 5'10½", but she hit that at 12, long blonde hair, green eyes, beautiful. We lived in Los Angeles and she surfed. And at 12 years old, you know, 5'10½", she looked like she was an older teenager. And my sister got into a spot of trouble for just a few years. She looked like maybe she was an alcoholic for a period of time. She definitely had some kind of ism. But what separates my sister from an alcoholic of my type is that when my sister was given a sufficient reason, she was able to stop her drinking for a number of years. And ever since, and she's become a moderate drinker. And she and I have had this conversation before because one time when I was bartending, I invited my sister and my mother to my bar and I wanted to get my mother drunk, my sweet little mother. I never saw her drunk and I wanted to get her drunk. So I'm like giving her some sweet fruity drinks that don't taste like alcohol. And both of them had too. And then they said the most fascinating thing in the world when I offered them a third one, which was, no, thank you. I'm starting to feel it. And that's a sentence I will never, ever understand because I don't understand why you would drink alcohol except for the effect produced by alcohol. I have never paid attention to what wine paired with salmon or what red wine I should have with my steak. When I drink, I love the way that it feels, and that's what I'm aiming for. So my sister and I have had these conversations because she's horrified, and I said to her, but why don't you just try to have a third and see what happens? And she thinks that's a terrible idea. Like, it's not something she wants to do. And I don't understand why she wouldn't just try and see if she likes it. But anyways, that's my sister. But my sister got me drunk for the first time when I was 4 years old. And I don't think that my sister got me drunk a lot because my mother was an at-home mom. She was active and present in my life. But there are a few things I remember about my sister getting me drunk. One is that I love the taste of beer. That's what I got. Another is that I love the dizzy feeling of being intoxicated. You know, I'm sure I didn't get a lot, but I remember that feeling. It's like the dizzy, almost falling down feeling. I love that. And then my sister used to tell people all the time, she would say, my little sister can drink big guys under the table. She had these stories about how much alcohol I could consume as a little girl. And I'm sure that they're not true. But I mean, I'm certain that they're not true, but that really isn't the point. The point is that my sister taught me early that you should be proud of it, that the goal is to be able to drink a lot. And so that's what I shot for all of the time. I thought we're supposed to outdrink people. And honestly, a lot of the times it really wasn't a problem, right? You know, I just had a tremendous capacity for alcohol. And what happened, you know, when I was 11 years old is when my drinking career, only in Alcoholics Anonymous do we call it that, but is when my drinking career started. And it's the story I tell every time. And it happened at a friend of Pete and I's and my girlfriend Heather Smith's house that Pete and I knew very well back then. And what happened for me the year, this setup that year. So actually Pete and I were in the same class that year. We have that sweet little picture of us together for the school yearbook. And then a series of things happened in succession. My father was brain damaged during surgery, during what should have been kind of a moderate surgery, and he was left totally incapacitated as a human being. I was my daddy's little girl, so that by itself was just a huge, just a tremendous loss. My mother was now out of her mind. Not, she wasn't a crazy person. I mean, she just was trying to figure out what to do with everything that was going on. She just, you know, and she was alone and she was an at-home mom and my father had been the one who worked, and it was just, there were a lot of things happening that year. And so my mother was distracted by that, and not because of anybody in my direct family, but because of people being in and out of my household following my father's brain injury. My house became an unsafe place for 11-year-old girls. And I lost my connection with God that year. I became an agnostic. And my mother started to take me to different churches to try to find God. But I remember now, because this is where I feel it now. I feel God in my chest. Like, I feel an expansion of God. It feels like joy. Joy and God feel like the same thing to me. And it expands in my chest, and that's where I feel God. And I remember having that as a little girl, and I remember losing the connection and just feeling like it was all air. Like, everything is just air out there. And in the midst of that, my girlfriend Heather invited me over for a slumber party. It was no big deal. We had a lot of slumber parties. But this particular weekend, her parents were out of the country for the weekend, and her high school sisters were babysitting us. And I walked into the kitchen on Saturday night, and her high school sisters were sitting around the kitchen table, and they were drinking from a bottle that said Seagram 7. And I don't think I'd ever had hard liquor before. My parents didn't keep it in the house. They weren't against it. They just weren't very interested in drinking. My dad would have a beer. My mother would have a glass of wine. It was just no big deal. But I remember I didn't want to hang out with Heather and the other little girls anymore. I wanted to get drunk with the big girls. And so I put my hands on my hips and I said, you know, I could drink you all under the table. And they laughed at me, but they gave me a liter of 7 and 7. And I remember a few things from that night. I remember I had never seen a 1 liter bottle of soda. There wasn't soda in my house. Special occasions maybe, but we weren't soda drinkers. We were Kool-Aid drinkers, but Tang, remember that Tang we had? I had never seen a 1 liter bottle of soda before. And I remember tipping it back in the kitchen, and I remember how sweet it was. And it's like Kool-Aid. I mean, it doesn't taste like Kool-Aid, but it's a sweet drink, like in the same family with, you know, a little edge to it, but it was sweet. And I remember tipping it back and glug, glug, glug. I remember drinking it. And then I don't remember anything that happened that night. I want to assure everybody, since I was 11, that there were no boys in the house. Nothing happened to me. But what I can tell you is that the last thing I recall is being in the kitchen. The next thing I remember is coming to on Heather's basement floor. We were living in, my family had moved from LA to Virginia to straighten my sister out. My parents really thought if they could get my sister out of the big city, she would straighten out. And she pretty much did. So, but Heather had an unfinished concrete basement, and I came to on that concrete basement in a training bra without any other clothing, without a blanket. I was really sick that morning. And I remember I walked through the house, and when I found my clothes, I had wet them the night before. So I guess that's why I had removed them. I remember I had to borrow some clothes from Heather to make it home. And I don't remember what happened that night, but I remember loving the experience, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And at 11 years old, I started looking for the girls. Carol Oates was another big one. Her parents, the girls whose parents weren't paying close attention, who had liquor cabinets. And I don't think that I became a weekend drinker yet at 11, but I started looking for that. And we would spend slumber parties and wait till the parents went to bed and take a little bit of off of, the parents' liquor cabinet, all of them, mix them together and hold our noses and drink them down, because it's gross when you mix it all together. But and it became a thing. And I did not get into big trouble growing up, but I got into a lot of trouble with my mother, my sweet Catholic mother, because I would come home drunk. My mother was really aware that I was drunk. My mother did not like the relationship I had with alcohol. And my mother made me go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 13 years old. It was 1985. And it was at True Episcopal Church in downtown Fairfax, Virginia. And I don't remember a lot about it. I remember that people were in a circle, and I remember they went around and shared. I don't think I did, because I think I'd remember. I remember I bummed a cigarette off somebody, and I was really excited that a grown-up gave me a cigarette. And I remember my daughter being excited for the same thing. And I was like, great. I'm so glad that they weren't afraid to do that, because, I always think in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have to be concerned when people, like, what our concern is, singleness of purpose, right? If I want to quit drinking, that's AA's business, right? That's what we're doing here. I'm not the moral authority on whether my, whatever. So I'm glad someone gave me a cigarette. That was the best part of my feeling towards Alcoholics Anonymous, to tell you the truth, when I was 13. And going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as I was growing up was kind of like penance, right? If you're a Catholic, you know what I mean. You get into trouble and you have to say some prayers or do something. I would get in trouble with my mother, and she would make me go to an AA meeting. And I don't remember a lot about them. I just remember trying hard not to get caught so that I wouldn't have to go, right? I just thought I didn't know what I was doing there, and I didn't hear anything interesting. Now I don't know what was said, but I wasn't open to it. That's for sure. And I went off to college, at 17 years old with this great hope. I felt, and like looking back, when I was 11 years old, like I said, I lost that connection to God. And I love that, the letters that Bill and Dr. Young wrote each other, I think in 1961, and Dr. Young having the freedom to say what his experience with alcoholics was, and specifically about alcoholics, having a lack of union with God, right? Like, that's the deep hole. Like, I knew I had a hole in me. I didn't know it was alcoholism. I didn't know that it was lack of union with God. I thought, I knew that there was something missing, but what I thought it was that when I looked back, everything was good when we lived in California. It's so funny. I was hiking with my daughter on Friday, and we were talking about like how badly my whole adult life, I couldn't wait to move back to California. And she, of course, the young one, right, says to me, well, of course, like that's where everything was safe and good before it, when things derailed, before things derailed. I thought, oh, how interesting. As I was growing up, what I thought when I looked back was that I was safe in California. But what I thought was, it's because that's where my people were. And then I was uprooted and taken to Fairfax, Virginia, and these are not my people, so I don't feel like I fit in. And if I could move somewhere that was like a big city, as if DC isn't, right? I mean, Fairfax is not rural at all. But I had this idea that if I could move to a big city, I would find my people and fit in. I didn't know that I was searching for God, that feeling was lack of union with God. And I got up to New York City to go to college at 17, and I didn't find my people there. I felt like a poser in New York City the same way that I felt like a poser in Fairfax, Virginia. I felt like there was, God, I love that, what Bill wrote in the 12 and 12, I think it's in the fifth step, that feeling he describes as anxious apartness. And I remember when I read the 12 and 12 and I read that description, anxious apartness, I thought, it's like the sky opened up for me. I wouldn't have thought of the words anxious apartness, but those two words best describe how I remember feeling from the time I was 11, which again makes sense because of that's when I lost my connection to God, when I became self-obsessed, when I started to think about myself in relation to others at all times. Do I fit in? Do people like me? Was my voice too loud just then? Are these the right shoes? How do girls know what top to put with what skirt? You know, like my thought, that's my head 100% of the time that I'm awake, right? And I think that it'll shut off when I find my people in New York and it doesn't happen. And this is the thing, you know, and why alcohol, that's okay. Marcy, is it Marcy, I think? That's why, you know, alcohol, you know, I have that voice running through my head at all times, and alcohol does a lot of things. No, what alcohol does for me changes on a given night. But on a given night, it may be like, I don't care anyways, because I don't know why I thought you guys were good enough for me. I shouldn't even be with you guys. I should be in Los Angeles, right? Or it may be like my head's just quiet, right? But whatever it is, once I get a few drinks in me, this isn't going anymore. And I feel good. The problem is that from the time I was 11, once I pick up a drink, I cannot control how much I drink or when I'm going to stop. And I had, you know, New York City was the first time, I'm 17 years old, it's the first time I really, really started to control my drinking. And what that would look like is it'd be like, Yvonne, last night was really embarrassing. You have to hit a new part of town now. You know, I had friends that were no longer friends with me. You know, I woke up and the next day they never wanted to see me again. And I would think, Yvonne, tonight you're just going to go to the bar and you're going to have two drinks and then you're going to go home. And I would go to the bar and have two drinks and go home and think, what was the big deal anyways, right? The problem is that I can only do that a time or two, right? Before something tells me that I'm making too big of a deal of this not drinking business. Everything is okay. I'm perfectly capable of having two drinks. So if I just want to have fun one night and let loose a little bit, get off my back, I'm okay, right? I drank myself out of New York University in a single semester. And my parents were very proud of me going there. And I, you know, I like to point out that we often speak euphemistically about drug usage in order to maintain singleness of purpose. But I want to be clear, I drank my way out of NYU. I didn't even use any drugs. I was just drinking every single night and I couldn't get to class in the morning. I was a terrible alcoholic. The thing for me is like good on people who maintain careers and drinking for long periods of time. But my experience is I do one or the other, right? I'm either drinking or I'm living in a way that my parents are proud of, but I cannot do both at the same time. And my drinking started the dark, desperate times that Bill and Bob both talk about. God, I related so much to Dr. Bob's nightmare in particular is so haunting, isn't it, when we read it? And the inability to stop drinking. And then, you know, particularly at the end of their story, when they talk about, you know, that, that combination of alcohol and heavy sedative, like I'm 18 years old and I'm in a dark, dark part of my drinking, because I can't stand being sober knowing that my life is kind of slipping through my fingers. And I have this idea that if I could move down to DC, I would be okay. Everything would be okay. And so I'm going to return to New York. I just need to calm down for a minute, like get my ducks in a row and come back. And so I moved back. My mother was so relieved that I was coming back. I was clearly in a lot of trouble. I mean, my mother would like send police to my apartment in New York City for a welfare check. Like that's what my mom's life looked like, right? Oh, and the other business is that one of those officers called her one day to say, I'd come get your daughter, you know, I was working down at Times Square, and my sweet Catholic mother was so horrified by that. And I don't even think she was embarrassed. I think she was horrified for me. You know, I don't even think it was how it made her look. I think my mother was just afraid of what was happening to her little girl's life. Right. And so I moved back down to DC and I get a job bartending in Adams Morgan in DC. And I have a pitch to myself that we're going to go back to the fun drinking, the party drinking that we used to have in high school. Everything's going to be okay. And I start with the party drinking, but I'm beyond that really. Like it's, you know, I can party drink once or twice and then it's on and I discover that I'm pregnant I would go for periods of time where I would stop getting loaded pregnant, but I couldn't stay stopped drinking. And I, you know, I found myself, in, you know, trying to get sober in early January of 1993. My daughter was born, you know, 2/3 through that month and had to spend the first 16 days of her life in the neonatal intensive care unit. And I did not mean to do that to her. You know, and the thing is, I knew that she was there because of me. It was 100%. I mean, she was there because of me. There was no question she was there because of me. But I also felt like I was such a big victim of the world of, you know, if the job hadn't, whatever, if the car hadn't, you know, I bought my first new car and then that didn't work out. And then if my parents would get off my back and support me, which is so funny because I remember thinking that if only my mother would support me a little bit. And the funny thing is like looking back today, I can't think of a single way that my mother could have supported me more than she did. I can't even figure out what I was pitching to myself at the time because my mother was so supportive, you know, and that little girl was released to me at 16 days old. And I'm sorry she was because 3 days later in February in DC, we're living in places that have no doors, windows, running water or electricity. And I lived like that with that little girl for the first 9 months of her life. I worked for an escort service because it was easier. And when my daughter was 9 months old, I got fired from my escort service because I could not show up to work sober. And I have to tell you, in Los Angeles, I'm 100% sure they don't care about that. But they do in DC, or they did in 1994. They cared, no, 93. It was still 93. They cared very much in DC. And I saw a Tawana from DC come on. There was a woman, Tawana, in DC, 7th and L Northeast is where she let me stay with her all the time. And, she would watch my baby Caitlin when I went to work for the escort service. And I went back to Tawana's house and said, I've just been fired. And, she said it was not a problem because her brother Buttons was a pimp. We could walk down to a payphone because it's 94, early 94. No, it's still late 93. Sorry. And, page Buttons because, you know, we had pagers then, not cell phones. And I could go to work for Buttons. And that night, Buttons came and picked me up and took me on the streets of DC. And this night was, what Norm Althy would talk about, seconds and inches, right? Because it would have changed the course of my life. I got into one car that night, one car only. I didn't take his money because we did not agree upon my value. And, that was a good thing because there was an undercover police officer and it put on lights and asked me to step out of the vehicle. And I stepped out of the vehicle saying, it's not what you think. And all I had was my, I had an ID on me. It was my Bishop O'Connell high school ID. And I was a cheerleader at Bishop O'Connell and I had, you know, the perm curly hair and it's just the sweet young face. And, the cops frisked me, but I didn't have a single dollar on me. So they could not arrest me for prostitution, but the officer told me to, that if he saw me on the street again that night, he would arrest me whether I had any money or not. And Buttons told me that I was bringing a little too much police heat to the neighborhood. He told me to go back to his sister's place and I could go to work for him in the morning and he would send somebody with a little money. And nobody came with any money. And I at 7:15 in the morning, I needed $20. I needed to get loaded. And I walked down to a payphone and called my mother. And when I heard her voice on the other end of the line, what I said to her was, if you bring me $20, I'll let you have the baby. My mother was more than happy to come pick up her 9-month-old granddaughter because she knew every time I disappeared that her granddaughter was unsafe. And I am so grateful for that because my daughter was also really sick. And part of the thing was I knew I couldn't take care of her anymore. I was beyond that. I was beyond any kind of normal living at this point. Obviously, no doors, windows, running water, electricity. But my mother took my daughter to the doctor that day, and she had 9 months old. She had double bronchitis, and the doctor said she would have died within a couple of days. And, you know, I'd have a different story. And I'm so glad that is not the story that I have. And I had lost custody of that little girl that day. Caitlin hates it when I say lost custody. She says I gave up custody that day. But you know, I gave up custody that day and I went off, you know, I went to one more detox, but I met a boy there and I left in the middle of the night and moved to Baltimore with him. The only problem with that arrangement, I had my 21st birthday in that detox and he was 21. And I just, you know, like, I know they say not to do that, but this was different. It was like God put us together for a reason. The only problem is I moved to Baltimore the next day and then his baby mama got out of jail and he said I had to go. And I was like, go where? Like, I didn't even know where I was going. And thank God his grandmother took pity on me and introduced me to someone I could rent a room from. And I know how to make money. So I went down to the 40 East show bar on 40 East Baltimore and got a job as a dancer, you know, in a place where they had back rooms for the customers to take the girls. And, my mother arrived on, She tracked me down on the phone at the club I worked at, in late January of 1994 and offered me a deal. And it was that, she had found a facility that had mothers and babies. And if I was willing to go into an institution for a year, that I could have custody of my daughter back. And, she wanted me to understand it was the only way I was going to get custody of my daughter back because we would have 24-hour supervision. And no one was going to let me have Caitlin without 24-hour supervision. And she wanted me to know that I could say no if I didn't want to go, but she would do everything in her power to make sure that I never saw my daughter again. And I hated her so much that day. And I'm so grateful for her powerful example, because I know today, that day it seemed like it came easy to her, but I know as an adult today that was maybe the most difficult thing she ever had to do in her life. And I know that. I'd missed my daughter's first birthday, her first Christmas, her first words, her first steps. And I did not want to get sober, you guys, but I wanted custody of my little girl again. And so I agreed to go into this institution. I went through detox first, and I don't count detox in my sobriety, but I came out of detox February 10th, 1994, sober as I am today. And that's the day I entered that institution. And the day I got custody of my daughter back, and she was holding onto my mom, screaming for her mommy. She wasn't talking about me. She didn't want me to touch her. That's what it looked like on my first day of sobriety. And you know, the thing is like, I wasn't even grateful for that opportunity. I was just angry. I was bitter. I didn't want to be here. I remember the institution I went through, it was hard for them to coordinate because it was like a federal program, and there are a lot of rules around who can watch babies in this program. So they couldn't get us to a lot of meetings. They got us to about 2 a month. And I remember telling them, like, I don't need a meeting twice a month. And I, like, there's no point in trying to make me go, because once I'm out of here, I'm never going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, like, it is so lame, right? Who would go to AA? And they would say, like, once I was out, I could go anywhere I want. But while I was in there, I had to go when they went. So I would go to the AA meeting, and I was never happy about it. And at the same time, here's the thing. I had been to AA meetings before, but I never paid attention in an AA meeting, and I can't tell you much about the meetings that I went to. What I can tell you about the meetings that I was going to while I was in that institution is that they were meetings of what I call meetings of convenience, right? Which is that, like, typically they were in our local Alano club. Nothing wrong with a meeting in an Alano club. And I don't mean to, to cast aspersions on any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm talking about something very specific. So like there'd be a meeting on Tuesday at 3 p.m. and I would show up at the local Lana Club, you know, with the treatment buggy. And that meeting would be listed in the directory, but it wouldn't belong to anybody. Like there'd be no commitments at that meeting. There'd be no secretary. It would just be like whoever showed up at that time at that day would just sit around the table and kind of usually the person with the most time would lead the meeting. They would pick a topic. It often had something about to do about our day, right? Like how our day was. And then we'd go around and share. And I want you to know, I have no problem sharing, but I really don't want to listen to what you guys have to say. You know, it's always all about me. But so those are the kinds of meetings I was going to. I didn't know. I don't think that I'd ever heard the word home group. I had heard about sponsor, but I was a little wary of that whole idea. But I'd never heard about a commitment. Like I didn't know that people had commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, you know, I was never really interested in going. But I was 11 months sober and I was in that local Alano club and they had a table and there were some flyers out and one of the flyers, and I wouldn't have known what this was then, but today I know that, the flyer was CIRCUPA, Southeast Regional Conference of Young People in AA. It was the kids from Midtown who were, it was a bid committee so that they could host CIRCUPA. Or it was a fundraiser. It must have been a fundraiser for the conference itself, I guess. They were having a spaghetti dinner and they were having a speaker named Sandy Beach. And one of the detoxes that I went through a couple of times used to take us to hear Sandy Beach do this 12-step workshop he used to do on Saturday mornings at NIH in Bethesda, Maryland. And I remember hearing Sandy because what happened is, like when I went to a meeting, when I was forced to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always sat in the back and I was little then, I would pull my knees up to my chest and try to sleep during the meeting because it was really important to me that you guys were aware of how contemptuous I was of your stupid little meeting I was forced to go to, right? Like if we had had cell phones back then, I would have been one of those obnoxious people on their phones in a meeting, right? But the best I could do at that time was to sleep through your meeting. and I remember that where we heard Sandy Beach, it was theater style. So the seats were very comfortable and it was easy to sleep during them. But I must have heard something Sandy said, and I don't remember what it was, but the reason I remember it is because I heard myself laugh out loud in this auditorium. And the reason I remember that is because I had this immediate reaction of like, don't laugh in AA. That's so lame. Like, don't do it. And so fast forward 11 months and I see this flyer of this speaker named Sandy Beach. And of course I remember his name because it's so unusual. I didn't even know who he was, right? I just knew he was the man that made me laugh. And I picked up that flyer and I took it back to my treatment facility. And for the first time in my life, I asked permission to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I asked if I could go hear that man speak and they gave me permission and I went. And I remember I was not quite a year sober because they had a sobriety countdown that day. And I was really upset that I couldn't stand up for a year. I was 11 months and some change. The thing is, I don't even remember Sandy speaking that night. And Sandy has always been one of my favorites, but I don't remember Sandy speaking that night. What I remember is walking into a room and there were about 200 young people, and they were in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know today, not every single one of them, but what I saw was a beehive of activity. And it was the first time that I saw a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I found attractive. And a lot of young ladies approached me that night. I was, like I said, 11 months sober. I was 22 years old. They were all around my age and younger. They had often had more time than I did. You know, there were 22-year-olds with 4 years of sobriety, and a bunch of ladies gave me their phone number, and they asked me to call them when I got out of treatment. And I got out of treatment 3 months later, and I called these ladies when I got out. I moved from treatment into the projects, and for some reason, I called these ladies that day, that Saturday, these young ladies. It was a Saturday I moved into the projects. And I called them that day, and I will be forever grateful for that. It's like, it was a grace thing because I was never, ever going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was free, and I'm free finally. But I call these ladies and they tell me to meet me at the Hyatt Regency in Arlington, Virginia at a certain time. And I show up and I don't even remember thinking that was weird that I showed up at this hotel that night. And it was the conference that weekend. They were having this young people's conference and they had me show up. I guess they knew I had no money. They had me show up after the banquet, but they had a seat for me at their table, this group of ladies. And the speaker that night was Karen Garrison from Venice, California. And I just remember laughing hysterically at her talk. And in particular, all of the parts where she's rolling with laughter, where she's doubled over laughing. I just, you know, that kind of laughter where you can't catch your breath kind of laughter, right? That's what she did for me that night. And I started to show up with these kids there and I started to go to a meeting every day, because I couldn't stand the thought. Well, okay. Also, there were some cute boys that went to meetings there. Let's be honest, but I couldn't stand the thought of missing a meeting, that there were things going on there without me. So I started to go every day, but I still didn't get a sponsor because I never sat down and asked somebody exactly what a sponsor was, but I had a pretty good idea that it's like asking somebody, will you be my mommy? And I didn't want somebody telling me what to do or stopping me from doing all the things that I wanted to do. So I had no intention of asking somebody. So if somebody asked me if I had a sponsor, I would just say I'm thinking about it. I'm trying to. And then 30 days into this gig, this young lady, Jennifer, appointed herself as my sponsor. And inside I'm screaming like, no, like I would have asked any other lady in that group before I would have asked her. She would have been my last choice. I had this terrible feeling. She was pretty mean. And it turns out that that's exactly what I needed, right? Because she was rude. And I don't know why, because I was obviously, you know, a bit of a spitfire out there. But for some reason, when I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I kind of lost my voice. And that turns out to be a good thing for me. It's good I found it again, but it was a good thing I lost it when I was a newcomer. Now I'm a year sober, but I'm a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous because I know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I've worked step zero, right? Nothing. I've got nothing, but, she told me, so I've been going to a meeting every day, but she told me I had to go to a meeting every day. And I tried to explain to her that I couldn't because I have a 2-year-old daughter. And she said, I didn't ask for your opinion, but she said it much meaner than that. And I just kind of like lost my voice. I didn't know what to say to her. And, so then I just asked like how I was supposed to do it. Because if a babysitter was $1 a night, it would be the same for me as $10,000 a night. I don't have $1. You know, my TANF check is $294 a month. My rent is $86. You know, diapers are $100, you know, whatever. I don't have 5 cents a night to pay a babysitter. That's for certain. And she had me, you know, my group was really, really good. I'm glad they were young people because they were super tolerant, but they also taught me about the first tradition and our common welfare comes first. So my daughter couldn't be disruptive in the meeting, and they taught me to sit in the back and, you know, and engage with her during the meeting. And when she got a little loud, you know, one of the young ladies often would take a turn and take her outside so I could stay in the meeting. And it was such a lovely, lovely way to grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was like growing up in a family, really, like a lot of siblings. I had a lot of siblings and Caitlin was the only child at that time. And so she was like, she became the little mascot, and she would do everything with us and go everywhere with us. And people were so good to me. And I'm so grateful for that, because the kind of alcoholic that I am, like, I went to 7 meetings a week till I was 4 years sober. And my sponsor actually at 4 years sober told me to start taking a night off a week. And I remember feeling like, I cannot go to AA one day a week, you know? And the thing is that I think the kind of, you know, I think of that line in the book sometimes about the extent to which he needs a spiritual solution depends upon, I just lost it, but the bottom, right? The extent of his bottom that's paraphrasing it, because I lost it as I was speaking, but I remember one day that line really hitting me, because I was going through one of those phases in Alcoholics Anonymous where I would make fun of others who weren't as busy in AA, which is so egotistical, right? And if the 12 steps are about humility, then I'm far from it, right? I remember I picked up this kind of conversation I heard from people sometimes, or these lines that were like, where you'd make fun of somebody in AA by saying, oh, I guess they don't have to do what I have to do. No, but like, lots of people don't have to do what I have to do. That's the thing. Like, lots of people don't sell their kid for $20, right? Lots of people don't live out on the streets the way that I did. Lots of people don't hit the bottom that I hit, and they don't have to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for the first 4 years. I'm the kind of alcoholic that required that. And I'm so grateful that I had a sponsor that asked me to do that, because I don't think that I would be here today if I hadn't. If I hadn't fully invested in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's the thing too, is I'm a quitter. I'm a runner. I run away from everything. I cannot stand the thought of failure. I have no problem knowing that I gave 50% of my effort to something I failed, because in my head, I know I will always tell myself that I could have done it if I had given my effort, but I didn't even really try. But I cannot stand failing at something. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me commitment. It taught me follow through. So anyways, this woman appointed herself as my sponsor. She made me start going to meetings every day. She taught me how to do that with a 2-year-old, with a toddler. And maybe I'll actually follow through with this time. Whoever heard me the other day, I totally forgot to close this loop, but my daughter became meeting trained, right? Meeting trained. And what that means is our meetings in the DC area at that time typically were an hour. There were maybe a couple we started having an hour and a half, but most meetings were an hour. And my daughter, who was a whirling dervish, would learned after a period of time to sit quietly once the meeting started and sit quietly throughout the meeting. And then once the meeting was over, she was wild and crazy again, right? And that came in such handy later. But anyway, so I'm a year sober. Jennifer is sponsoring me. She's having me go to meetings every day. I'm doing that. But at the same time, I kind of think of Alcoholics Anonymous as an extracurricular activity. I've had a lot of extracurricular activities, and what they look like is that they're what I do for the hour and a half. You know, I mean, it's like a 4-hour whole thing, you know, every meeting, the drive there, that you show up early. My sponsor told me to be at every meeting an hour early. I was at meeting an hour early. Where I got sober in DC, it was typical to stand around outside the meeting afterwards for about an hour chatting before you went home. They don't really do that in California. It was like the weirdest. It's just everybody leaves. They come early. They don't stay late. They go to restaurants or whatever, but they don't stand in the parking lot. It was a weird adjustment. But anyway, So it's a big block of time, but what I do with the rest of my day is my business. Thank you very much. And so, you know, I'm living in the projects, and I am looking around at the meetings that I go to, and I'm feeling really sorry for myself because, you know, what it looks like to me is what happens for everybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous is that they get sober, they get a boyfriend, they get a cute apartment, they get a cute car, like, and that's just what life looks like for everybody except for me, right? And I'm feeling so sorry for myself about it. And the funny thing is that I have all these tremendous gifts. I've been given. And by gifts, I don't mean I have gifts like, you know, like the gift of gab. I mean, like, I have gifts that people have given me that I don't understand are gifts. Like, so I'm driving, it may not be a cute car, but I'm driving a car because a church donated a car to me because I was a single mother. It was a 1978 Honda CVCC powder blue with one white door. It was a stick shift. I have a car that I can drive from point A to point B, but all I can do is look at that car and think everyone else has a cute car, right? I live in the projects. I'm feeling sorry for myself because I live in the projects. And I got to tell you, I have worked with so many single mothers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wish that I could get them into, I mean, so many. Gosh, I have a sponsee, Rebecca, 9 years sober now, but when I first started sponsoring her and she had a 2-year-old boy, the shelter she lived in was a house where they crammed in 2 families in every bedroom. Her, she lived with a mother with three kids, her and her son, in this tiny bedroom. They had cockroaches, they had bed bugs, and that other mother would let her children watch TV until 3 o'clock in the morning, and Rebecca's son could not fall asleep, and there was nothing we could do about it. There were no rules, there were no requirements, and I thought, like, God, all those times I thought that the projects I lived in were terrible, like, I had this sweet little apartment all to myself. Here's the thing, is that my perception was wrong, right? I looked at everything wrong. I got all these sweet gifts for no other reason than the fact that I was given the gift of getting sober. I got all these gifts, and I can't see these as good things happening for me, right? I'm feeling sorry for myself because it's not what other people have, right? And so it occurs to me at a year of sobriety that I know how to make money. and I went back to work for an escort service, and I was able to do that for just a few months before I realized that I would have to drink in order to live that way. And at about 18 months of sobriety, I came clean to my sponsor. And the thing is, like, I like to say, like, I didn't trust my sponsor at all. I really didn't. But at 18 months of sobriety, the one thing I knew was that my sponsor could not do a worse job with my life than I was doing myself. And that's what I needed to know in order to surrender. And I surrender to my life to my sponsor as an experiment. And you know, it's funny because my sponsor today, Pat Yeo, will say, like, it doesn't even matter what the direction is. It matters that we surrender, right? And that was the key. And everything changed for me. My sponsor told me, like, so I told you I lived life really heavy. If anybody asked me how I was, I would suck the life out of the room with my answer. You know, people just, I cried all the time. My life was so sad. And my sponsor told me at 18 months of sobriety, when I surrendered to her, that I was no longer allowed to tell anybody how I was. She told me she wanted me to put a smile on my face and pretend to be a happy person. And if anybody asked me how I was to lie and say I was fine and ask them how they were and ask them about their day. And so I started to pretend I was a happy person. And I thought she was doing that for you guys. Like, I knew I was heavy. I just didn't think it was my fault. And I thought the direction was to make life easier for you guys. I had no idea that it was going to change me. And I don't know when it happened, but I don't know if it was 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. But I remember, like, thinking back and thinking, like, I hadn't felt sad in a long time. You know, like, my sponsor had trained my feet into living life lightly by just pretending to live life lightly. And, you know, the other thing that happened for me is that when I was 2.5 years sober, because I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I even got my Hal Marley pin, Attitude of Gratitude, which I keep and I love it, and it will always, you know, I'll wear it or it's safe. And I was active in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did not get the connection with God back. And when I was 2.5 years sober, I inadvertently, well, nobody would do this on purpose, but I clipped off some cornea, and I'm sorry, it's terrible to, you know, I went blind over the next 2.5 months, and I experienced excruciating pain because I developed necrotizing bacteria in my eye. I had an ulcer in the eye, and what happened is the cornea wouldn't grow back over to cover the hole. And if you've ever experienced something where you have where you cut your cornea or you get a piece of metal in your cornea or whatever, you know that it just constantly hurts all the time until it's healed. Well, the hole kept getting bigger and bigger, and there was no way they could fix it. I was just in excruciating pain all of the time. And I had to put eye drops in my eye every half an hour, 24 hours a day. And I didn't have to set an alarm clock to wake me up every 30 minutes because I couldn't sleep 30 minutes at a time because of the physical pain I was in. And I saw a doctor, it was a Saturday night. I saw them every day because they needed to monitor the injury. And this particular doctor at Johns Hopkins told me that Saturday evening, he said, "Yvonne, there's nothing more I can do for you. 50-50, you're going to lose that eye altogether in the next week." And I was totally devastated. And my mom took me from the doctor's appointment to drop me off at my Saturday night meeting because I couldn't drive. And on the way there, I decided I was going to go, down to Southeast DC the next day and get some opiates because, specifically opiates, because I didn't feel like I could go another 24 hours in the kind of pain I was in. And somebody approached me at the meeting unsolicited and told me what I needed to do was go home and pray for the removal of the obsession I had with my eye. And I went home and plotted killing her for a couple of hours because I was so angry that she thought that it was an obsession. And I get it now. I thought she thought I was faking it, which clearly, like, there was something huge wrong. But I didn't understand. I didn't understand what she was asking me to do. And I got down on my knees that night, and I still didn't believe in God. And I had the hardest time praying at all times. But I got down on my knees, and I don't know what I said, but I know the spirit of it was, God, please remove the obsession I have with my eye, whatever. And I crawled back into bed and I fell asleep, but I didn't wake up for 6 hours. And when I woke up 6 hours later, because I looked at my clock, I couldn't believe that I saw sunlight coming in. I couldn't believe I'd slept until there was sunlight. And then I kind of like felt my eye and I thought, oh, it's hardly painful. Like, it was just, I had a little bit of very tolerable pain. Well, what had happened overnight is it had almost completely closed is what happened. And I remember standing that morning in the projects with the cheap blinds and the dust motes coming through and just feeling my chest expand with the feeling of God. Like, I felt God that morning. And I also realized though that, like, because I thought that what was happening to me was terrible. This was a terrible experience. I've gone blind. I'm still blind in my left eye. I've had 2 corneal transplants. They just haven't worked out for me. Turns out my immune system is too strong. How about that? Silver lining and everything. But I'm still blind in that eye. I thought that was a terrible thing. And from what I judged to be a terrible thing, I received this great gift, this feeling with God. And the doctor said that morning when I saw him, he was the same doctor he saw me the night before. And he said he had no medical explanation for the healing that had occurred in my eye overnight. And I'm so grateful for the lesson that I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I just want to tell you that, you know, when the prostitution thing didn't work out, I went back to school. And because my daughter had to go to school with me sometimes. This is the meeting train thing. Sometimes she had to go to class with me because I couldn't afford a babysitter and my classes went too late. But because my daughter was meeting trained, she would sit through school and be quiet like it was a meeting. And I'm so grateful. All the other parents would be like, I don't know how you get your kid to do that. I couldn't tell them it's meetings, you know, and I got straight A's in college because I learned to do what I'm supposed to do. And I learned to finish things and I got a scholarship to GW University. And then I got to go to law school after that. And my mother got to sit on the White House lawn and watch me graduate with honors. And she saw me start law school. And I'm so grateful for that. Because before she died, she said she knew that her granddaughter was safe in my custody. And you guys, I'm a litigator today. You know, I like to say, for one of the largest law firms in the world, and they think I'm a square. Like, they think I'm a total goody two shoes. It's like crazy. And I am so grateful. You guys are the ones that know me, right? You really know me. And I got to raise that little girl. I got to, like I said, I was cuddling her earlier today because she wants her mommy. And she found Alcoholics Anonymous without me telling her. and I walked her down the aisle a couple of years ago. And you guys, everything, my life is so sweet, despite, you know, this is a tough year, but my life is so sweet, and I'm so grateful to you and Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.